crowds, the enormity of the first great joust they have ever seen. My sisters and Elizabeth, Anthony's wife, are seated beside me. We are starting to form a court of beautiful women. Already people are speaking of an elegance that has never before been seen in England. The Burgundian cousins are out in force, their armor the most stylish, their poetry the best for meter. But Anthony, my brother, is superb. The court goes mad over him. He sits a horse with such grace, and he carries my favor and breaks the lances of a dozen men. No one can match his poetry either. He writes in the romantic style of the southern lands. He tells of joy with a tinge of sadness, a man smiling at tragedy. He composes poems about love that can never be fulfilled, of hopes that summon a man across a desert of sand, a woman across a sea of water. No wonder every lady at court falls in love with him. Anthony smiles, picks up the flowers that they throw into the arena, and bows, hand on his heart, without asking any lady for her favor. I knew him when he was just my uncle, Thomas remarks. He is the favorite of the day, I say to my father, who comes to the royal box to kiss my hand. What is he thinking of? He demands of me, puzzled. In my day we killed an opponent, not made a poem about them. Anthony's wife, Elizabeth, laughs. This is the Burgundian way. These are chivalrous times, I tell my father, smiling at his broad-faced puzzlement. But the winner of the day is Lord Thomas Stanley, a handsome man who lifts his visor and comes for his prize, pleased to have won. The motto of his family is shown proudly on his standard, sans changer. What does it mean? Richard mutters to his brother. Without changing, Thomas says, and you would know if you studied rather than wasting your time. And do you never change? I ask Lord Stanley. He looks at me, the daughter of a family that has changed completely, turned from one king to another, a woman who has changed from being a widow into being a queen, and he bows. I never change, he says. I support God and the king and my rights, in that order. I smile. Pointless to ask him how he knows what God wants, how he knows which king is rightful, how he can be sure that his rights are just. These are questions for peace, and our country has been at war too long for complicated questions. You are a great man in the jousting arena, I remark. He smiles. I was lucky not to be listed against your brother, Anthony, but I am proud to joust before you, Your Grace. I bend from the Queen's box to give him the prize of the tournament, a ruby ring, and he shows me that it is too small for his big hand. You must marry a beautiful lady, I tease him, a virtuous woman whose price is beyond rubies. The finest lady in the kingdom is married and crowned, he bows to me. How shall we, who are neglected, bear our unhappiness? I laugh at this. It is the very language of my kinsmen, the Burgundians, who have made flirtation a form of high art. You must endeavor, I say. So formidable a knight should found a great house. I will found my house, and you will see me win again, he says. And at his words, for some reason, I feel a little shiver. This is a man who is not just strong in the jousting arena, I think. This is a man who would be strong on the battlefield. This is a man without scruple, who will pursue his own interest. Formidable indeed. Let us hope he is true to his motto and never changes from his loyalty to our House of York. When the goddess Melusina fell in love with the knight, he promised her that she would be free to be herself if she would only be his wife. They settled it that she would be his wife and walk on feet, but once a month she might go to her own chamber, fill a great bath with water, and for one night only, be her fishy self. And so they lived in great happiness for many years, for he loved her, and he understood that a woman cannot always live as a man. He understood that she could not always think as he thought, walk as he walked, breathe the air that he took in. She would always be a different being from him, listening to a different music, hearing a different sound, familiar with a different element. He understood that she needed her time alone. He understood that she had to close her eyes and sink beneath the glimmer of the water, and swish her tail, and breathe through her gills, and forget the joys and the trials of being a wife. Just for a while. Just once a month. They had children together, and they grew in health and beauty. He grew more prosperous, and their castle was famous for its wealth and grace. It was famous also for the great beauty and sweetness of its lady, and visitors came from far away to see the castle, its lord, and his beautiful, mysterious wife. As soon as I am crowned queen, I set about establishing my family, and my mother and I become the greatest matchmakers in the kingdom. Will this not cause more enmity? I ask Edward. My mother has a list of lords for my sisters to marry. You have to do it, he assures me. They complain that you are a poor widow from a family of unknowns. You have to improve your family by marrying them to the nobility. We are so many. I have so many sisters. I swear we will take up all the eligible young men. We will leave you with a dearth of lords. He shrugs. This country has been divided into either York or Lancaster for too long. Make me another great family that will support me when York wavers or when Lancaster threatens. You and I need to link ourselves to the nobility, Elizabeth. Give your mother free rein. We need cousins and in-laws in every county in the land. I shall ennoble your brothers and your grey sons. We need to create a great family around you, both for your position and for your defense. I take him at his word, and I go to my mother and find her seated at the great table in my rooms, with pedigrees and contracts and maps all around her, like a commander raising troops. I see you are the goddess of love, I observe. She glances up at me, frowning in concentration. This is not love. This is business, she says. You have your family to provide for, Elizabeth, and you had better marry them to wealthy husbands or wives. You have a lineage to create. Your task as queen is to watch and order the nobility of your country. No man must grow too great. No lady can fall too low. I know this. My own marriage to your father was forbidden, and we had to beg pardon from the king and pay a fine. I would have thought that would have put you on the side of freedom and true love. She laughs shortly. When it was my freedom and my love affair, yes. When it is the proper ordering of the court, no. You must be sorry that Anthony is already married now that we could command a great match for him. My mother frowns. I am sorry that she is barren and in poor health, she says bluntly. You can keep her at court as a lady-in-waiting, and she is of the best family, but I don't think she will give us sons and heirs. You will have dozens of sons and heirs, I predict, looking at her long lists of names and the boldly drawn arrows between the names of my sisters and the names of English noblemen. I should do, she says with satisfaction, and not one of them less than a lord. So we have a month of weddings. Every sister of mine is married to a lord, except for Catherine, where I go one better and betroth her to a duke. He is not yet 10 years old, a sulky child, Henry Stafford, the little Duke of Buckingham. Warwick had him in mind for his daughter Isabel. But as the boy is a royal ward since the death of his father, he is at my disposal. I am paid a fee to guard him, and I can do with him what I want. He is an arrogant, rude boy to me. He thinks he is of such a great family, he is so filled with pride in himself, that I take a pleasure in forcing this young pretender to the throne into marriage with Catherine. He regards her and all of us as unbearably beneath him. He thinks he is demeaned by marriage to us, and I hear he tells his friends, boasting like a boy, that he will have his revenge, and we will fear him one day. He will make me sorry that I insulted him one day. This makes me laugh, and Catherine is glad to be a duchess, even with a sulky child for a husband. My 20-year-old brother, John, who is luckily still single, will be married to Lord Warwick's aunt, Lady Catherine Neville. She is Dowager Duchess of Norfolk, having wedded and bedded and buried a duke. This is a slap in the face to Warwick, and that alone gives me mischievous joy. And since his aunt is all but 100 years old, marriage to her is a jest of the most cruel sort. Warwick will learn who makes the alliances in England now. Besides, she must soon die, and then my brother will be free again, and wealthy beyond belief. For my son, my darling Thomas Grey, I buy little Anne Holland. Her mother, the Duchess of Exeter, my husband's own sister, charges me 4,000 marks for the privilege, and I note the price of her pride and pay it so that Thomas can inherit the Holland fortune. My son will be as wealthy as any prince in Christendom. I robbed the Earl of Warwick of this prize, too. He wanted Anne Holland for his nephew, and it was all but signed and sealed. But I outbid him by 1,000 marks. A fortune. A king's fortune, which I can command and Warwick cannot. Edward makes Thomas the Marquis of Dorset to match his prospects. I shall have a match for my son Richard Grey as soon as I can see a girl who will bring him a fortune. In the meantime, he will be knighted. My father becomes an earl. Anthony does not gain the dukedom that he joked about, but he does get the lordship of the Isle of Wight, and my other brothers get their places in royal service or in the church. Lionel will be a bishop, as he wanted. I use my great position as queen to put my family into power, as any woman would do, and, indeed, as any woman risen to greatness from nothing would be advised to do. We will have our enemies. We have to make connections and allies. We have to be everywhere. By the end of the long process of marriage and ennoblement, no man can live in England without encountering one of my family. You cannot make a trade, plough a field, or try a case without meeting one of the great Rivers family or their dependents. We are everywhere. We are where the king has chosen to place us. And should the day come that everyone turns against him, he will find that we, the Riverses, run deep and strong, a moat around his castle. When he loses all other allies, we will still be his friends, and now we are in power. We are loyal to him, and he cleaves to us. I swear to him my faith and my love, and he knows there is no woman in the world who loves him more than I do. My brothers and my father, my cousins and my sisters, and all our new husbands and wives promise him their absolute loyalty. Whatever comes, whoever comes against us. We make a new family, neither Lancaster nor York. We are the Woodville family, ennobled as Riverses, and we stand behind the king like a wall of water. Half the kingdom can hate us, but now I have made us so powerful that I do not care. Edward settles to the business of governing a country that is accustomed to having no king at all. He appoints justices and sheriffs to replace men killed in battle. He commands them to impose law and order in their counties. Men who have seized the chance to make war on their neighbors have to return to their own barns. The soldiers discharged from one side or another have to go back to their homes. The warring bands who have taken their chance to ride out and terrorize must be hunted down. The roads have to be made safe again. Edward starts the hard work of making England a country at peace with itself once more. A country at peace, instead of a country at war. Then, finally, there is an end to the constant warfare when we capture the former King Henry, half lost and half witted in the hills of Northumberland, and Edward orders him to be brought to the Tower of London for his own safety and for ours. He is not always in his right mind, God keep him. He moves into the rooms in the tower and seems to know where he is. He seems to be glad to be home after his wandering. He lives quietly, communing with God, a priest at his side night and day. We don't even know if he remembers his wife or the son she told him was his. Certainly he never speaks of them, nor asks for them in faraway Anjou. We don't know for sure if he always remembers that once he was king. He is lost to the world. Poor Henry. And he has forgotten everything that we have taken from him. Summer 1468. Edward trusts Warwick with an embassy to France, and Warwick seizes the opportunity to get away from England and away from court. He cannot bear the rising of our tide and the slow decline of his own hopes. He plans to make a treaty with the King of France, and promises him that the government of England is still in his gift, and that he is going to choose the husband for the York heiress Margaret. But he is lying, and everyone knows that his days of power are over. Edward listens to my mother, to me, and to his other advisers, who say that the Dukedom of Burgundy has been a faithful friend where France is a constant enemy, and that an alliance with Burgundy could be made for the good of trade, for the sake of our cousinship, and could be cemented with the marriage of Edward's sister Margaret to the new Duke himself, Charles, who has just inherited the rich lands of Burgundy. Charles is a key friend to England. The Duke of Burgundy owns all the lands of Flanders, as well as his own dukedom of Burgundy, and so commands all the lowlands of the north, all the lands between Germany and France, and the rich lands in the south. They are great buyers of English cloth, merchants and allies to us. Their ports face ours across the English Sea. Their usual enemy is France, and they look to us for alliance. These are traditional friends of England, and now, through me, kinsmen to the English king. All this is planned without reference to the girl herself, of course, and Margaret comes to me when I am walking in the garden at Westminster Palace, all in a fluster, as someone has told her that her betrothal to Dom Pedro of Portugal is to be put aside, and she is now to be sold to the highest bidder, either to Louis of France for one of the French princes, or to Charles of Burgundy. "It'll be all right," I say to her, tucking her hand in mine so she can walk beside me. She is only 22, and she was not raised to be the sister of a king. She is not accustomed to the way that her husband-to-be can change with the needs of the moment, and her mother, torn between her divided loyalties to her rivalrous sons, has quite failed to care for her daughters. When Margaret was a little girl, she thought she would be married to an English lord and live in an English castle, raising children. She even dreamed of being a nun. She shares her mother's enthusiasm for the church. She did not realize when her father claimed the throne and her brother won it that a price must always be paid for power, and it will be paid by her as well as the rest of us. She doesn't realize yet that though men go to war, it is women who suffer, perhaps more than anyone. "I won't marry a Frenchman. I hate the French," she says hotly. "My father fought them. He would not have wanted me to marry a Frenchman. My brother should not think of it. I don't know why my mother considers it. She was with the English army in France. She knows what the French are like. I am of the House of York. I don't want to be a Frenchwoman.
You won't be, I say steadily. That is the plan of the Earl of Warwick, and he no longer has the ear of the king. Yes, he takes French bribes, and he favors France. But my advice to the king is that he should make an alliance with the Duke of Burgundy, and that will be a better alliance for you. Just think, you will be my kinswoman. You will marry the Duke of Burgundy and live in the beautiful palace at Lille. Your husband-to-be is an honored friend of the House of York, and my kinsman through my mother. He is a good friend, and from his palace you will be able to come on visits home. And when my daughters are old enough, I shall send them to you, to teach them the elegant court life at Burgundy. There is nowhere more fashionable and more beautiful than the court of Burgundy. And as Duchess of Burgundy, you shall be godmother to my sons. How will that be? She is partly comforted. But I am of the House of York, she says again. I want to stay in England, at least until we have finally defeated the Lancastrians. And I want to see the christening of your son, the first York prince. Then I shall want to see him made Prince of Wales. You shall come to his christening whenever he comes to us, I promise her, and he will know his aunt is his good guardian. But you can further the needs of the House of York in Burgundy. You will keep Burgundy a friend to York and to England, and if ever Edward is in trouble, he will know that he can call on the Burgundy wealth and arms. And if ever again he is in danger from a false friend, he can come to you for help. You will like to be our ally over the sea. You will be our haven. She drops her little head on my shoulder. Your Grace, my sister, she says, it is hard for me to go away. I have lost a father, and I am not sure that my brother is not still in danger. I am not sure that he and George are true friends. I am not certain that George does not envy Edward, and I am afraid of what my Lord Warwick might do. I want to stay here. I want to be with Edward and with you. I love my brother George. I don't want to leave him at this time. I don't want to leave my mother. I don't want to leave home. I know, I say gently. But you can be a powerful and good sister to Edward and to George as the Duchess of Burgundy. We will know that there is always one country that we can depend on to stand our friend. We will know that there is a beautiful Duchess who is a Yorkist through and through. You can go to Burgundy and have sons, York sons. Do you think I can found a House of York overseas? You will found a new line, I assure her, and we will be glad to know that you are there, and we will visit you. She puts a brave face on it, and Warwick puts a two-faced face on it, and escorts her to the port of Margate, and we wave her away, our little Duchess. And I know that of all of Edward's brothers and sisters, George the unfaithful and Richard the boy, we have just sent away the most loving, the most loyal, the most reliable Yorkist of them all. To Warwick, this is another defeat at my hands and at the hands of my family. He promised that Margaret would have a French husband, but he has to take her to the Duke of Burgundy. He planned to make an alliance with France, and he said that he had control of the decision-making in England. Instead, we are to marry into the royal house of Burgundy, my mother's family, and everyone can see that England is commanded by the Rivers family and that the king listens only to us. Warwick escorts Margaret on her wedding journey with a face as if he is sucking lemons, and I laugh behind my hand to see him overpowered and outnumbered by us, and think myself safe from his ambition and his malice. Summer, 1469.
I am wrong. I am so wrong. We are not so powerful. We are not powerful enough. And I should have taken more care. I did not think. And I, of all people who was afraid of Warwick before I had even met him, should have thought of his envy and his enmity. I did not foresee. And I, of all queens with growing sons of my own, should have foreseen that Warwick and Edward's bitter mother might come together and think to place another York boy on the throne in place of the first boy they had chosen, that the kingmaker would make a new king. I should have been more aware of Warwick as my family pushed him out of his offices and won the lands that he might have wanted for himself. I should have seen also that George, the young Duke of Clarence, was bound to interest him. George is a son of York, like Edward, but malleable, easily tempted, and above all, unmarried. Warwick looked at Edward and me and the growing strength and wealth of the Riverses that I have put around Edward, and began to think that perhaps he might make another king again, a king who would be more obedient to him. Three beautiful daughters we have, one newborn, and we are hoping, with rising anxiety, for a son. When Edward gets news of a rebel in Yorkshire calling himself Robin of Reedsdale, a fanciful name meaning nothing, a petty rebel hiding himself behind a legendary name, raising troops, slandering my family, and demanding justice and freedom and the usual nonsense by which good men are tempted from minding their fields to go to their deaths. Edward pays little attention at first, and I, foolishly, think nothing of it at all. Edward is on pilgrimage with my family, my grey sons Richard and Thomas, and his young brother Richard, showing himself to the people and giving thanks to God. And I am travelling to meet him with the girls, and though we write every day, we think so little of the uprising that he does not even mention it in his letters. Even when my father remarks to me that someone is paying these men, they are not armed with pitchforks, they have good boots, and they are marching in good order, I pay him no attention. Even when he says a few days later that these are men who belong to someone, peasants or tenants or men sworn to a lord, I hardly listen to his hard-won wisdom. Even when he points out to me that no man takes up his scythe and thinks he will go and fight in a war, someone, his lord, has to give the order, even then I pay him no attention. When my brother John says that this is Warwick's country, and most likely the rebels are raised by Warwick's men, I still think nothing of it. I have a new baby, and my world revolves around her carved, gold-painted crib. We are on progress in southeast England, where we are beloved. The summer is fine, and I think, when I think at all, that the rebels will most likely go home in time to bring in the harvest, and the unrest will go quiet of its own accord. I am not concerned until my brother John comes to me, his face grave, and swears that there are hundreds, perhaps thousands of men in arms, and it has to be the Earl of Warwick about his old business of making mischief, as no one else could muster so many. He is king-making again. Last time he made Edward to replace King Henry. This time he wants to make George, Duke of Clarence, brother to the king, the son of no importance, to replace my husband, Edward, and so to replace me and mine as well. Edward meets me at Fotheringay, as we had arranged, quietly furious. We had planned to enjoy the beautiful house and grounds in the midsummer weather, and then travel on to the prosperous town of Norwich together, for a great ceremonial entry to this most wealthy city. Our plan was to knit ourselves into the pilgrimages and feasts of the country towns, to dispense justice and patronage, to be seen as the king and queen at the heart of their people, nothing like the mad king in the tower and his madder queen in France. "But now I have to go north and deal with this," Edward complains to me. "There are new rebellions coming up like springs in a flood. I thought it was one discontented squire, but the whole of the North seems to be taking up arms again. It is Warwick. It must be Warwick, though he has said not a word to me. But I asked him to come to me, and he has not come. I thought that was odd, but I knew he was angry with me. And now this very day I hear that he and George have taken ship. They have gone to Calais together. God damn them, Elizabeth. I have been a trusting fool. Warwick has fled from England, George with him. They have gone to the strongest English garrison. They are inseparable, and all the men who say they are out for Robin of Reedsdale are really paid servants of George or Warwick. I am aghast. Suddenly the kingdom that had seemed quiet in our hands is falling apart. It must be Warwick's plan to use all the tricks against me that he and I used against Henry. Edward is thinking aloud. He is backing George now as he once backed me. If he goes on with this, if he uses the fortress of Calais as his jumping point to invade England, it will be a brother's war, as it was once a cousin's war. This is damnable, Elizabeth. And this is the man I thought of as my brother. This is the man who all but put me on the throne. This is my kinsman and my first ally. This was my greatest friend. He turns from me, so I cannot see the anger and the distress in his face. And I can hardly breathe at the thought of this great man, this tremendous commander of men, coming against us. You are sure? George is with him, and they have gone to Calais together? He wants the throne for George? I am sure of nothing, he shouts in exasperation. This is my first and foremost friend, and with him is my own brother. We have been shoulder to shoulder on the battlefield. We have been brothers in arms as well as kinsmen. At the Battle of Mortimer's Cross, there were three suns in the sky. I saw them myself, three suns. Everyone said that was a sign from God for me and for George and for Richard, the three sons of York. How can one son leave the others? And who else betrays me with him? If I cannot trust my own brother, who will stand by me? My mother must know of this. George is her darling. He would have told her he is plotting against me, and she has kept his secret. How can he betray me? How can she? Your mother, I repeat. Your mother backing George against you. Why would she do such a thing? He shrugs. The old story. Whether I am my father's son, whether I am legitimate, born and bred a York. George is saying that I am a bastard, and that makes him the true heir. God knows why she would support this. She must hate me for marrying you and taking your part more than I even dreamed. How dare she? I can trust no one but you and yours, Edward exclaims. Everyone else I trust is cut out from under my feet. And now I hear that this Robin in Yorkshire has a list of demands that he wants me to meet, and that Warwick has announced to the people that he thinks they are reasonable. Reasonable! He promises that he and George will land with an army to remonstrate with me. Remonstrate? I know what he means by that. Is this not the very thing we did to Henry? Do I not know how a king is destroyed? Did Warwick's father not take my very own father to remonstrate with King Henry, planning to cut him from his wife and from his allies? Did he not teach my father how to cut off a king from his wife, from his allies, and now he thinks to destroy me with the same trick? Does he think that I am a fool? And Richard? I ask anxiously, thinking of his other brother, the shy boy who has become a quiet and thoughtful young man. Where are Richard's loyalties? Does he side with his mother? It is his first smile. My Richard stays true to me, thank God, he says briefly. Richard is always true to me. I know you think him an awkward, sulky boy. I know your sisters laugh at him, but he is honest and faithful to me. Whereas George can be bribed to left or to right. He is a greedy child, not a man. God only knows what Warwick has promised him. I can tell you that, I reply fiercely, It's easy. Your throne, and my daughter's inheritance.
I shall keep them all.
He takes my hands and kisses them.
I swear I shall keep them all.
You go to the city of Norwich as we planned. Do your duty. Play the queen. Look as if you are untroubled. Show them a smiling and confident face. And I will go and scotch this snake's plot before it gets out of the ground.
Do they admit that they hope to overthrow you? Or do they insist they just want to remonstrate with you?
He grimaces.
It is more that they will overthrow you, sweetheart. They want your family and your advisers exiled from my court. Their great complaint is that I am ill-advised and that your family are destroying me.
I gasp.
They are slandering me?
It is a cover, a mumming, he says. Don't regard it. It is the usual song of this not being a rebellion against the king, but against his evil advisers. I sang this song myself, as did my father, as did Warwick against Henry. Then we said that it was all the fault of the queen and the Duke of Somerset. Now they say it is your fault and your family around you. It is easy to blame the wife. It is always easier to accuse the queen of being a bad influence than to declare yourself against the king. They want to destroy you, and your family, of course. Then, once I am alone before them, without friends and family, they will destroy me. They will force me to declare our marriage a sham, our girls all bastards. They will make me name George as my heir, perhaps to cede my throne to him. I have to drive them to open opposition, where I can defeat them. Trust me, I will keep you safe. I put my forehead to his. I wish I had given you a son, I say, very low. Then they would know that there could be only one heir. I wish I had given you a prince.
Time enough for that, he says steadily. And I love our girls. A son will come, I don't doubt it, beloved. And I will keep the throne safe for him. Trust me.
I let him go. We both have work to do. He rides out from Fotheringay behind a harshly rippling standard and surrounded by a guard ready for battle to go to Nottingham to the great castle there and wait for the enemy to show himself. I go on to Norwich with my daughters to act as if England is all mine, as if it is all still a fair garden for the Rose of York, and I fear nothing. I take my grey sons with me. Edward offered to have them ride with him for a first taste of battle, but I'm fearful for them, and I take them with me and the girls. So I have two very sulky young men, aged 15 and 13, as I make my progress to Norwich, and nothing will please them, as they are missing their first battle. I have a state entry, and choirs singing, and flowers thrown down before me, and plays extolling my virtue and welcoming my girls. Edward bides his time in Nottingham, summoning his soldiers again, waiting for his enemy to land. While we wait, playing our different parts, wondering when our enemies will come and where they will land, we hear more news. In the city of Calais, with special permission from the Pope, which must have been sought and gained in secret by our own archbishops, George has married Warwick's daughter, Isabel Neville. He is now Warwick's son-in-law, and if Warwick can put George on Edward's throne, Warwick will make his own daughter queen, and she will take my crown. I spit like a cat at the thought of our turncoat archbishops writing to the Pope in secret to aid our enemies, of George before the altar with Warwick's girl, and of Warwick's long, slow-burning ambition. I think of the pale-faced girl, one of the only two Neville girls, for Warwick has no son of his own and cannot seem to get any more children, and I swear that she will never wear the crown of England while I live. I think of George, turning his coat like the spoiled boy he is, and falling in with Warwick's plans like the stupid child he is, and I swear vengeance on them both. I am so certain that it will come to a battle, and a bitter battle between my husband and his former tutor in war, Warwick, that I am taken by surprise, just as Edward is taken by surprise, when Warwick lands without warning and meets and smashes the gathering royal army at Edgecote Moor near Banbury, before Edward is even out of Nottingham Castle. It is a disaster. Sir William Herbert, the Earl of Pembroke, lies dead on the field, 1,000 Welshmen around him. His ward, the Lancaster boy Henry Tudor, left without a guardian. Edward is on the road to London, riding as fast as he can to arm the city for siege, about to warn them that Warwick is in England, when armed figures block the road before him. Archbishop Neville, Warwick's kinsman, appointed by us, steps up and takes Edward, his own king, prisoner, telling him, as he is surrounded, that Warwick and George are already in the kingdom, and the royal army has already been defeated. It is over. Edward is beaten, even before battle is declared, even before he had his war horse harnessed. The wars, which I thought had ended in peace, our peace, are over with our defeat, without Edward even drawing his sword, and the House of York will be founded on the puppet plaything George, and not on my unborn son. I am at Norwich, pretending to confidence, pretending to queenly grace, when they bring me a mud-stained messenger from my husband. I open the letter. Dearest wife, prepare yourself for bad news. Your father and your brother were taken at a battle near Edgecote, fighting for our cause, and Warwick has them. I too am a prisoner, held at Warwick's castle of Middleham. They took me on the road on my way to you. I am unhurt, as are they. Warwick has named your mother as a sorceress, and he says that our marriage was an act of witchcraft by you and her. So be warned, both of you are in grave danger. She must leave the country at once. They will have her strangled as a witch if they can. You too should prepare for exile. Get yourself and our daughters to London as fast as you can. Arm the tower for a siege and raise the city. As soon as the city is set for siege, you must take the girls and go to safety to Flanders. The charge of witchcraft is very grave, beloved. They will execute you if they think they can make it stick. Keep yourself safe above anything else. If you think it best, send the girls away at once, secretly, and place them with humble people in hiding. Don't be proud, Elizabeth. Choose a refuge where no one will look. We have to live through this if we want to fight to claim our own again. I am more grieved at bringing you and them into danger than anything else in the world. I have written to Warwick to demand to know the ransom that he wants for the safe return of your father and your brother John. I don't doubt he will send them back to you, and you can pay whatever he demands from the treasury. Your husband, the one and only King of England, Edward. A knock at the door of my presence chamber and the flinging open of the door makes me leap to my feet, expecting, I don't know, the Earl of Warwick himself, with a bundle of greenwood stakes for burning my mother and me. But it is the Mayor of Norwich, who greeted me with such rich ceremony only days before. Your Grace, I have urgent news, he says. Bad news. I am sorry. I take a little breath to steady myself. Tell me. It is your father and your brother. I know what he is going to say. Not from foreknowledge, but from the way his round face is creased with worry at the thought of the pain he is bringing me. I know it from the way that the men behind him gather together, awkward as people who bring the worst tidings. I know it from the way that my own ladies-in-waiting sigh like a breeze of morning and gather behind my chair. No, I say. No, they are prisoners. They are held by Englishmen of honour. They must be ransomed. Shall I leave you? He asks. He looks at me as if I am sick. He does not know what to say to a queen who came into his town in glory and will leave it in mortal danger. Shall I go and come back later, Your Grace? Tell me, I say. Tell me now, the worst there is, and I will bear it somehow. He glances at my women for help, and then his dark eyes come back to me. I am sorry, Your Grace. Sorrier than I can rightly say. Your father, Earl Rivers, and your brother, Sir John Woodville, were taken in battle. A new battle, between new enemies. The King's army against the King's own brother, George, the Duke of Clarence. The Duke seems to be in alliance now with the Earl of Warwick against your husband. Perhaps you knew? In alliance against your gracious husband and you. Your father and brother were taken fighting for Your Grace, and they have been executed. They were beheaded. He snatches one quick look at me. They would not have suffered, he volunteers. I am sure it was quick. The charge? I can hardly speak. My mouth is numb, as if someone had punched me in the face. They were fighting for an ordained king against rebels. What could anyone say against them? What could be the charge? He shakes his head. They were executed on the word of Lord Warwick, he says quietly. There was no trial. There was no charge. It seems my Lord Warwick's own word is now law. He had them beheaded, without trial or sentence, without justice. Shall I give the orders for you to be escorted to London? Or shall I arrange for a ship? Will you go overseas? I am to go to London, I say. It is my capital city. It is my kingdom. I am not a foreign queen to run to France. I am an Englishwoman. I live and die here. I correct myself. I will live and fight here. May I offer you my deepest condolences? To you and to the king. Do you have news of the king? We were hoping that your gracious self could reassure us. I have heard nothing. I lie. They will not learn from me that the king is a prisoner in Middleham Castle, that we are defeated. I will leave this afternoon, within 2 hours. Tell them. I will ride to claim my city of London, and then we will reclaim England. My husband has never lost a battle. He will defeat his enemies and bring all traitors to trial and justice. He bows. They all bow and go out backwards. I sit on my chair like a queen, the gold cloth of estate over my head, until the door is closed on them. And then I say to my ladies, "Leave me. Prepare for our journey." They flutter and they hesitate. They long to pause and pet me, but they see the grimness in my face and they trail away. I am alone in the sunlit room, and I see that the chair that I am sitting on is chipped. The carving under my hand is faulty. The cloth of estate over my head is dusty. I see that I have lost my father and my brother, the kindest, most loving father that a daughter ever had. And a good brother. I have lost them for a chipped chair and a dusty cloth. My passion for Edward and my ambition for the throne put us, all of us, into the very forefront of the battle and cost me this first blood. My darling brother and the father I love. I think of my father putting me on my first pony, and telling me to lift up my chin and keep my hands down, to keep tight hold of the reins, to tell the pony who is master. I think of his cupping my mother's cheek in his hand and telling her that she is the cleverest woman in England and he will be guided by none but her, and then going his own way. I think of his falling in love with her when he was her first husband's squire and she his lady,
who should never even have looked at him. I think of his marrying her the moment she was widowed, in defiance of all the rules, and there being called the handsomest couple in England, married for love, which nobody but the two of them would have dared to do. I think of him at Reading, as Anthony described him, pretending to know everything and with his eyes rolling in his head. I could even laugh for love of him, thinking of his telling me that he can call me Elizabeth only in private, now I am queen, and that we must become accustomed. I think of how he puffed out his chest when I told him that I was marrying his son to a duchess, and that he himself would be an earl. And then I think of how my mother will take her loss, and that it will be me who has to tell her that he had a traitor's death for fighting in my cause, after fighting all his life for the other side. I think of all of this, and I feel weary and sick to my soul, wearier and sicker than I have ever felt in all my life, even worse than when Father came home from the Battle of Towton and said that our cause was lost, even worse than when my husband never came home at all from St. Albans, and they told me he died bravely in a charge against the Yorks. I feel worse than I have ever done before, because now I know that it is easier to take a country into war than to bring it to live at peace. And a country at war is a bitter place to live, a risky place to have daughters, and a dangerous place to hope for a son. I am welcomed in London as a heroine, and the city is all for Edward. But it will make no difference if that butcher Warwick kills him in prison. I make my home for now in the well-fortified Tower of London with my girls and my grey sons. They are obedient, scared as puppies now that they see that not every battle is won, and not every beloved son comes safe home. They are shaken by the loss of their Uncle John, and they ask every day for the safety of the king. We are all grieving. My girls have lost a good grandfather and a beloved uncle, and know that their father is in dreadful danger. I write to my kinsman, the Duke of Burgundy, and ask him to prepare a safe hiding place in Flanders for me, my grey sons, and my royal girls. I tell him that we must find a little town, one of no importance, and a poor family who can pretend to take in English cousins. I must find somewhere for my daughters to hide, that they will never be found. The Duke swears he will do more than this. He will support the city if they turn out for me and for York. He promises men and an army. He asks me what news I have of the king. Is he safe? I cannot write to reassure him. The news of my husband is inexplicable. He is a king in captivity, just like the poor King Henry. How can such a thing be? How can such a thing continue? Warwick is still holding him at Middleham Castle, and persuading the lords to deny that Edward was ever king. There are those who say that Edward will be offered the choice, either to abdicate his throne for his brother, or climb the scaffold. Warwick will have either the crown or his head. There are those who say it is only days now before we hear that Edward is thrown down and fled to Burgundy, or dead. I have to listen to such gossip in the place of news, and I wonder if I am to be widowed in the same month that I have lost my father and my brother. And how shall I bear that? My mother comes to me in the second week of my vigil. She comes from our old home at Grafton, dry-eyed, and somehow bowed, as if she has taken a wound to her belly and is bent over the pain. The moment that I see her, I know that I won't have to tell her that she is a widow. She knows she has lost the great love of her life, and her hand rests on the knot of her girdle all the time, as if to hold in a mortal wound. She knows that her husband is dead, but no one has told her how he died or why. I have to take her into my private room, close the door on the children, and find the words to describe the death of her husband and son.
and it was a shameful death, for good men, at the hand of a traitor. I am so sorry, I say. I kneel at her feet and clasp her hands. I am so sorry, Mother. I will have Warwick's head for this. I will see George dead. She shakes her head. I look up at her and see lines on her face that I swear were never there before. She has lost the glow of a contented woman, and her joy has fallen away from her face and left weary lines. No, she says. She pats my plaited hair and says, Hush, hush. Your father would not have wanted you to grieve. He knew the risks well enough. It was not his first battle, God knows. Here. She reaches inside her gown and gives me a handwritten note. His last letter to me. He sends me his blessing and his love to you. He wrote it as they told him he would be released. I think he knew the truth. My father's handwriting is clear and bold as his speech. I cannot believe I will not hear the one and see the other again and again. And John, she breaks off. John is a loss to me and to his generation, she says quietly. Your brother John had his whole life before him. She pauses. When you raise a child and he becomes a man, you start to think that he is safe, that you are safe from heartbreak. When a child gets through all the illnesses of childhood, when a plague year comes and takes your neighbor's children and yet your boy lives, you start to think he will be safe forever. Every year you think, another year away from danger, another year towards becoming a man. I raised John, I raised all my children, breathless with hope. And we married him to that old woman for her title and her fortune, and we laughed, knowing that he would outlive her. It was a great joke to us, knowing that he was such a young husband to such an old woman. We laughed to make mock of her age, knowing her to be so much closer to the grave than he. And now she will see him buried and keep her fortune. How can such a thing be? She breathes a long sigh, as if she is too tired for anything more. And yet I should know. Of all the people in the world, I should have known. I have the sight. I should have seen it all. But some things are too dark to foresee. These are hard times, and England is a country of sorrows. No mother can be sure that she will not bury her sons. When a country is at war, cousin against cousin, brother against brother, no boy is safe. I sit back on my heels. The king's mother, Duchess Cecily, shall know this pain. She will have this pain that you are feeling. She will know the loss of her son George. I spit. I swear it. She will see him die the death of a liar and a turncoat. You have lost a son, and so shall she, my word on it. So will you, by that rule, my mother warns me. More and more deaths, and more feuds, and more fatherless children, and more widowed brides. Do you want to mourn for your missing son in future days, as I am doing now? We can reconcile after George, I say stubbornly. They must be punished for this. George and Warwick are dead men from this day. I swear it, Mother. They are dead men from this day. I rise up and go to the table. I will tear a corner from his letter, I say. I will write their deaths in my own blood on my father's letter. You are wrong, she says quietly. But she lets me cut a corner from the letter and give it back to her. There is a knock at the door, and I wipe the tears from my face before I let my mother call, Enter. but the door is flung open without ceremony. And Edward, my darling Edward, strolls into the room as if he had been out for a day.